fundamental innovation on the world scene, and it would have wide impact beyond Europe as well as within it. So, political changes, very significant, largely along fairly familiar lines if you use the standards of other societies, but with this particular new emphasis. Third category, major developments in culture. Three fundamental shifts occurred, setting the framework for more detailed changes. In the first place, obviously, the establishment of printing in Europe, though initially devoted primarily to religious tracts, opened up massive expansions of opportunities for Europeans to have contact with the written word, to gain new sources of information, and this was a fundamental shift in the European cultural horizon. Literacy developed pretty systematically in the 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries, and by the 18th century, Western Europe had the highest rates of literacy of any large society in the world. Other developments that followed from printing obviously included the emergence of newspapers, weekly for the most part. By the end of the 17th century, there's a new cultural apparatus here that's very significant. Development number two, the Protestant Reformation, despite some effective Catholic response, shattered the unity of Western Christianity, led to all sorts of internal conflicts and tensions, but in the long run, tended to reduce religious commitment in Europe and tended to increase an attachment to some idea of religious toleration. I know this simplifies a lot of very complicated developments, but I think that was the long run impact. And finally, the granddaddy of all three major cultural shifts, the scientific revolution itself. European science, as we've discussed previously, had prior to this time shared many features directly borrowed from many other scientific traditions, particularly those of the Middle East. But in the 17th century, the range of scientific discovery and the increasing sense on the part of many intellectuals and even through popularization, ordinary people, that the key to truth lay through science, not faith, not tradition. This was a fundamental change that no other scientific endeavor in other societies had yet matched. European science obviously was not totally unique. We want to remember that vigorous scientific traditions existed in other societies, but the overall contours of the scientific revolution were really novel. And indeed, when you combine printing and growing literacy, the printing of materials directed at relatively ordinary people, when you combine this with science, one could argue that of all the three areas we've been emphasizing, commercialization, political change, and culture, it's really the culture that makes Western Europe increasingly stand out from the standards of other societies. And this was not just an abstract development. The other intriguing aspect of cultural change in early modern Europe was how it penetrated into relatively prosaic activities and into the attitudes of relatively ordinary people. Let me offer a few illustrations from a fascinating array. Illustration number one. If you lost a valued object in 1600, and you looked for it, you couldn't find it, but you really wanted to get it, you would normally employ a local cunning man, a magic person who had a magic stick, and he would go around and shake the stick, and hopefully the stick would help identify the lost object. And of course, if it didn't, you'd done the best you could. In 1720, same scenario, you lose something, you look for it, you really want it back, can't find it. You would no longer turn to the local cunning man because increasingly this person didn't exist. Instead, particularly if you lived in cities, you would do one of two things or both. You would advertise the lost object in the local newspaper, or you would go to the city lost and found office, offices of the sort that were increasingly established from the later 17th century onward. Specific illustration of a broader phenomenon. During the 17th and 18th centuries, magical approaches to nature magical approaches toward dealing with problems like lost and found begin to pass from favor. Lots of people still believe in them. If you look at supermarket tabloids, lots of people still believe in them today, but they are no longer dominantly fashionable. And instead, people turned increasingly to a new kind of calculation of risk and a new kind of rational or scientific approach to nature, such that magical approaches now were either outright disapproved or relegated to obscure corners in some areas of popular life. Second illustration, quite a different category. In 1650, if you had a child, you might wait to name it for about 2 years. And when you did name it, you would probably choose either the name of a past relative or the name of another child you had had who had died, or possibly a religious name. In 1750, when you had a child, you would normally name it now quickly. The child would still be likely to die, but the sense of the importance of dealing with the individual from birth was now on the upswing, and that meant a new kind of naming practice. Second, when you did name the child, you would not normally pick a family name. You would never, never pick a name from a kid you'd had who'd already died. And indeed, you would often stay away from religious names. The new fashion was to look for new kinds of names that would express greater individuality, that would give a child a greater sense of being his or her own person. Another category, and I'll end with this one. It's a fascinating array. In 1650, if your father told you, a young girl, to get married and whom to marry, you might protest individually, but you would almost certainly lose. Papa and maybe Mama would tell you whom to marry, and the marriage would be arranged on the basis of family property considerations. In 1750, if Papa told you whom to marry, you're still a young girl, and you felt you could not love that person, you might be able to persuade Papa that this was a match that should not occur because marriage had to be based on affection. And in a few places, like some parts of Switzerland, if Papa didn't agree, you could actually go to court and get the arrangement canceled. The notion that marriage should be based on love, the notion that marriage should be a union that involved affection and even sexual expression and not just property arrangements, was born in this period. The list is long, and the basic point, obviously, is clear. Fundamental shifts in Western culture, science, religious division, growing literacy, yielded impressive and varied expressions at the level of very popular beliefs and practices, affecting a sense of the individual, affecting a sense of family and community, affecting, obviously, attitudes toward risk and nature. This is a big deal change, and it marks the extent to which the cultural realm was probably particularly the area where the West was striking out in new directions. Now we come back to some cautions and final conclusions. Remember that Western Europe, despite all the exciting things happening there, was not the only place in the world. Lots of places continued to ignore what was going on in the West. Actually, some areas saw a few developments by coincidence that were not totally different from those occurring in the West. For example, in these same early modern centuries, many Confucian leaders in China began to attack popular superstition and magic in order to make Chinese life more rational, less dependent on folk superstition than had been the case. The West is not the only place where interesting developments are occurring, not the only place we want to look to as we get a sense of the early modern period as a whole. But the changes that did occur in the West in the early modern centuries, when we take the big changes approach, had three final implications. Number one, they almost guaranteed that additional change would occur in the West itself. With governments taking on new roles, with new attitudes toward nature, even with new attitudes toward children, increasingly interested in seeing children develop in a creative fashion. changes of this sort almost assured that additional change was underway. And of course, the increasing pace of commercialization set the fundamental framework here. Second, these changes would color European reactions to other societies. We've already noted that Europeans, as they moved into new positions in the world, often began to judge other societies by their technological level. Well, now they might also begin to judge other societies by how much superstition seemed to be present, by how children were treated. It became increasingly easy for Europeans to think of other places as uncivilized because they didn't measure up to the new standards that were present in Europe itself. And by the 19th century, for happily a fairly brief time, many Westerners, in fact, did decide that there were no traditions other than the Western that really merited the term civilization at all. And finally, third, the developments that occurred in the West would set a challenging target for other societies as they looked at the West and increasing Western success and wondered what they might copy. For example, to take an obvious one, the European notion of the nation-state, the idea that the state and culture should coexist, proved to be very popular in other parts of the world from the late 18th century onward. But other Western developments, for example, like new attitudes toward children, might come with somewhat greater difficulty. The European package, the Western model, if you will, was increasingly complicated, and this would affect responses to Western activities in the wider world as well.
Lecture 22, The Rise of Russia.
The early modern centuries saw what is incontestably a significant rise of Russia in world affairs. It was also a period in which Russian political and cultural patterns changed significantly as well. We need to remember, and this has come up earlier in our discussions, that Russia is a bit of a problem for world historians. I've tried to resolve the problem by an emphasis on Russia and possibly a larger Eastern European zone as a distinct civilization. Part of the problem, frankly, stems not from world history at all, but from an older tradition in European history that saw Russia treated in European history textbooks, but often relegated to a small chapter late in the section, which frankly hardly does justice to the significance of Russia in this period and beyond. But there are some issues here. The issues are compounded indeed in this period by new relationships that Russia developed with the West itself. Early in the early modern period, for example, Russian leaders, the new czars, began to send emissaries to the West and to utilize Western artists and architects. For example, the Kremlin was designed by Italian architects, though using Russian themes to some extent. So Russia's relationship with the West is one of the issues we will have to deal with in this discussion, but it was not a relationship that involved absolute identity. It remains preferable to look at Russia as a separate case. We also, without belaboring the point, need to remember that a larger East European zone existed even beyond Russia's borders that shared with Russia, in some cases, commitment to the Orthodox version of Christianity, commitment to agricultural systems that had some rough points in common. The issue of an East European zone, of which Russia was now the clear leader, is something that we need to keep in mind as we turn to developments in the early modern period and beyond. The most obvious theme, and one that's important both for Russia itself and for much of the Eurasian world, the most obvious theme of Russia in the early modern period was territorial expansion. It didn't happen all the time. There were setbacks, but between 1450 and 1750, Russian territory expanded steadily in several directions, not yet reaching its present dimensions, but without question, creating an empire of substantial size. Russia was indeed one of the great gunpowder empires of the early modern period. In some ways, over time, the most successful and durable one, because elements of the empire still exist, and we need to look at that vantage point for Russia as well. Not totally easy to identify what factors pushed Russia to expansion. Without question, one early one, and we've touched on it before, involved the issue of trying to drive the Mongols further away, pressing further into Central Asia in order to keep the Mongol threat at bay. That could at least be an initial stimulus to expansion. Russia was also moved, at least rhetorically, by the notion that Russia had become the heir to the Byzantine Empire. The notion of Russia as the third Rome, first the Roman Empire itself, then Byzantium, then Russia, again, whose Tsar had carefully married one of the last heiresses of the Byzantine throne, the notion of Russia inheriting an imperial mantle may not have justified all the expansion, but certainly provided an interesting rhetorical cover. There was also periodically, and this could link to the Byzantine idea, there was also periodically some sense of religious mission. Russia, for example, would frequently insist that it had some role to play in the Middle East in defense of Christianity, and particularly in defense of Orthodox Christianity. A number of motives were at play. It was also true that as the early modern period progressed, the Russian state itself developed a direct stake in expansion. Expansion was one of the ways the Tsars could justify their rule to themselves and others. And many individual Russians, both landowners seeking new territories, particularly to the east, and more ordinary Russians seeking new land opportunities themselves, groups like the Cossacks, who were used so actively in expansion. Individual groups developed a stake in expansion as well. Expansion, again, took several directions. Most important during much of this period was the expansion southward into Central Asia and to the borders of the Ottoman Empire. Here, Russia began to influence world affairs in two fundamental ways, with a third issue also interesting. There was the direct contact with the Ottoman Empire. By the 17th and certainly the 18th centuries, Russian-Ottoman conflict, recurrent, increasingly moved to the advantage of the Russians, and Russia was involved in pressing the Ottoman Empire and gradually pushing it back, gaining new territories to the south and to some extent the southeast in the process. The second huge change that Russian expansion in this direction involved was the elimination, at least for a long period, of Central Asia as an independent factor in Eurasian affairs. You will easily remember, at so many points in our discussions to date, the nomadic groups of Central Asia played such a tremendous role recurrently in migrations, invasions, trade connections among major societies. Russian expansion, along with some Chinese and Ottoman expansion, now placed most of Central Asia under the control, at least nominally, of an organized state. And the independent action of Central Asian nomads began to diminish. Central Asia indeed became something of an internal colony for the Russians, providing opportunities to gain raw materials, gain access to products that would then feed the larger development of the Russian economy, a very important development in larger world historical terms. The same expansion, finally, quite obviously, began to produce a significant Muslim minority in Russia itself. The Tsar during the early modern period was very careful to present himself to his Muslim subjects as a Muslim ruler, or at least as a ruler that operated in a Muslim tradition, didn't claim to be Muslim directly. This partly allowed the Tsar to continue to call on some of the Mongol precedents, although Russia was increasingly casting itself as a European state. The Mongol precedent was not entirely forgotten. But the interaction between the Russian state, the majority Russian population, and this growing Muslim minority was an interesting development at the time, and it obviously continues to play a major role in Russian affairs to the present day. The second direction of Russian expansion was obviously westward, started a little later, but was nevertheless marked. Russia began to move into Ukraine, into other territories that brought it directly into East Central European affairs. And by the end of the 17th century, Russia was playing a role in military and diplomatic interactions with countries like Sweden, Prussia, Austria-Hungary, some of the major players in this part of Europe. And soon, although more after 1750 than before, Russia would assert a role in European diplomacy more generally. This push westward also brought new minorities into Russian rule. A significant Jewish population was acquired, particularly as Russia moved into Polish territory. German ethnic minorities played an important role in Russian activities. The third direction of Russian expansion was eastward, across the Ural Mountains, into Siberia, and ultimately even beyond. This brought Russia, by the 18th century, into direct contact with China. A mid-18th century treaty, the Amur River Treaty, established a border between China and Russia that turned out not to be eternal, but did indicate the extent to which Russia was now a player, a minor player, in East Asian as well as Central, West Asian, and European affairs. And during the 18th century, Russia pressed beyond East Asia proper into Alaska, and Russian explorers moved south from Alaska down into present-day Northern California. Russian expeditions, trading expeditions, even reached the northernmost island of Hawaii, where remnants of two Russian forts still exist. This was clearly a truly expansionist society, creating by 1750 one of the largest land masses under single rule that had ever existed before. This expansion created, and we've touched on the implicit point here already, this expansion created Russia as a multinational society, interestingly, at the very time that Western Europe was increasingly emphasizing the nation-state, and this multinational quality would be both a strength and a challenge to Russia from this point onward. This expansion also created Russia as a frontier society, an element that I think we too often forget. Russia had significant frontier conditions, particularly in the East, but also in parts of Central Asia, and pioneering activity, cowboy-like developments, are an important part of Russian history, certainly by the 17th and 18th centuries, and this was one reason that in the 19th century, the great French observer Alexis de Tocqueville would so liken developments in Russia to those in the United States, two giant societies, two societies exploring their frontiers, a relationship that remains interesting to contemplate even again to the present day. Russian expansion had one other consequence quite clearly, familiar enough from other world history expansions previously, and that was the question of how to hold this thing together. Two devices were particularly used in the early modern period. First of all, was a strong assertion of the power of the central state and its ruler, the Tsar, Russian for Caesar, again the connection with the idea of the Third Rome. State authority was widely asserted, but frankly, it was often fairly hollow because the key device for holding this vast territory together, or at least much of it, depended on essentially an agreement between the Russian state and the landlord class, both big landlords and gentry-level landlords, who were given increasing powers over Russian peasants, the serfs, political as well as economic powers, power to run local courts, power to administer justice, power to punish criminals, as well as power to levy taxation and labor service. This decentralization into an estate-based management provided Russia the opportunity to establish at least normal political stability, even in its huge new territories, and it was not explicitly inconsistent with the idea of a powerful czar as well, so long as the czar and his major nobles managed to agree. Once in a while, that agreement broke down and times of trouble ensued, but for the most part, it held steady because both parties, both the czar and the great nobles, had a stake in preserving this system. Russian serfdom then, which was a new development in this period. Russian peasants in the post-classical period had been relatively free. Russian serfdom in this period has to be seen then as, first of all, a major development in its own right, but second, as a response to political as well as economic conditions. In the later 17th century, Russia embarked on another pattern of change that was truly important at the time and is fascinating in its analytical implications because it calls upon us to assess once again the relationship between Russia and other parts of Europe, and it calls upon us as well to assess the first instance of a phenomenon that would show up at other places later in world history, the phenomenon of Westernization. The basic facts are pretty simple. A new czar in the late 17th century, Peter the Great, decided that in order to maintain Russia's military mission, in order to further Russia's goals of being seen as a European power and not primarily an Asian power, significant changes had to occur that would involve Russia's imitation of patterns then visible in the West. Peter the Great, clearly one of the great characters, not necessarily one of the nice characters, but one of the great characters of world history, almost 7 feet tall. Peter the Great had himself traveled to the West, particularly to the Netherlands. He had worked as a shipbuilding artisan to learn techniques in this area, and he obviously was deeply imbued with the sense that the West had a lot to offer Russia that he, as Tsar, needed to impose. Westernization reforms under Peter took several directions. First, and these are in no particular order of priority, first were what one might call cosmetic changes, but intriguing. Peter the Great insisted that his nobles trim off their Mongol-like beards and adopt Western rather than Asian dress. Famous cartoons in the period actually have Peter himself trimming the beards of somewhat reluctant noblemen. Upper-class women were also urged to dress in Western fashion, and every indication is they were happier about this change than some of the men were. Western cultural institutions were imported into Russia. Notably, for example, the ballet, fundamentally a French dance form, was imported into Russia and became so deeply anchored there that obviously it became known almost as a Russian institution. Western art was encouraged. Other aspects of Western cultural presence were encouraged from Peter the Great onward. So, cultural change in the cosmetic or aesthetic directions, truly important. Another interesting example that I find intriguing was the importation of the German custom of using fir trees at Christmas time. Russia adopted the Christmas tree a century or more before it would be adopted in other parts of Western Europe and the United States. Little things, but adding up to a significant effort to switch Russia's cultural orientation in significant directions. Second set of changes, also cultural broadly construed, but with much clearer purpose. Second set of changes involved efforts to improve Russian education, particularly for the upper classes, and Russian scientific work. Under Peter, new universities were established. The State University of St. Petersburg, still one of the major institutions in Russia, was established at the end of Peter the Great's reign. Scientific academies were set up. Sometimes they debated scientific and technological changes that nobody was really interested in implementing in Russia, but nevertheless an apparatus for joining Russia to a broader European scientific community, an apparatus was unquestionably established. Peter the Great decreed that all nobles should receive training in mathematics, at pain, at least on paper, of not being allowed to marry if they didn't obtain an educational certificate. Lots of changes here designed, obviously, to improve Russia's scientific and technical capacity and improve the training of the people who would serve as Peter the